This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
And you're listening to AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson. Back sitting in for Matt McNeil, who's on vacation I think all the way through next week as well. So I'll be sitting in again Monday through Thursday, and then next Friday, is it Jack Rice or somebody like that?
I think it's Andrew? Brett next Brett. Friday. Jack will be in later on.
Okay. I heard Jack yesterday for a little while. So we got it covered here. Matt, if you're listening, which you shouldn't be because you're on vacation, you should truly take a vacation from your show and not listen to it. So I hope you're the only person in Minnesota not listening to the show. So we are kind of, and it's Friday, and I thought it would be fun to celebrate a little bit. We're going to talk about things later on in the show, like the origins of why Awake is called Awake and things like that. You're probably wondering what I'm talking about, but you will find out if you keep listening. Not you, Matt. You don't. You're not listening. So another thing, though, we want to celebrate is Infrastructure Week. And we're talking about real Infrastructure Week, not Trump Infrastructure Week, which never happened.
It was going to be the most tremendous, biggest infrastructure ever in the likes of which no one has ever seen.
But it never happened. And now I think we're on our second Infrastructure Week, and we've actually got a bill, a $2,700 bill. And some of the details, they might be slightly different than this, but they were $65 billion for broadband, $66 for railways, $343,000 for roads and bridges. And the American Society of Civil Engineers says 43% of roads are in poor or bad condition. 42% of bridges are 50 or more years old. And we're speaking to you from Minneapolis, the place where just a little more than 13 years ago, the biggest and most driven on bridge in the whole state, in the whole area, the whole region, collapsed while people were on the bridge, including a school bus. It was unbelievable when it happened. But it happened, and it was because the bridge wasn't inspected properly. It was more than 40 years old, which was it's supposed to be its original lifespan. Now, 42% of bridges are 50 or more years old. And our entire system of roads and bridges was built starting in the 1950s. And throughout the, it took like 25 years to get the whole system built up. And then Republicans immediately insisted on not ever funding any maintenance for any of it. So it's in shambles. And we all know this. And but now we have an opportunity to build it back. And like President Biden says, we're going to build back better. And something that's extremely interesting that I discovered kind of in a fluky way, I'm going to explain in just a moment. But first, let me tell you what it's all about. There's an article in the New York Times, and it's titled, "Can Removing Highways Fix America's Cities?" And they've actually been doing this in some cities, Rochester, New York. The main freeway going right through the center of Rochester, New York, was built in the 1950s to speed suburban commuters and to and from downtown. And Rochester's inner loop destroyed hundreds of homes and businesses, replacing them with a broad concrete trench separated downtown from the rest of the city. That's happened in virtually all cities in America, including the Twin Cities. And but now, in Rochester, they're looking to repair the damage. They started by filling in the nearly mile-long section of the sunken road, slowly stitching a neighborhood back together. Today, visitors of the Interloop's eastern segment would hardly know a highway once ran beneath their feet. As mid-century highways reach the end of their lifespans, cities across the country are having to choose whether to rebuild or to reconsider them. And a growing number, like Rochester, are choosing to take them down. And this has been starting to show success in places like Rochester, New York. And so here's my little story about how I found out about this. My wife's side of our family had a family reunion. Out-of-towners came into town, and one of my sisters-in-law, her name is Mary, and she's always been involved in a lot of things having to do with climate change and things like that. And it's weird because we get in fights because she's a Trump supporter. No, she's not. She's opposite of a Trump supporter. Anyway, so I saw her on Wednesday night and asked what she was doing. And she said she was trying to tear down Highway 94. And I kind of thought, well, good luck with that. But then she explained it a little further. And it turns out that there's a whole thing going on right here in the Twin Cities. And so Mary is here. Mary Morse Marty is here, and also is Alex Burns. Alex has worked with the Sierra Club, but right now both Alex and Mary are volunteers for a group called the I-94 Stakeholders Coalition. So, hello. You can talk now.
Hello. It's so great to be here. Thanks, Todd.
Sure. Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask you guys to do a lot of the explaining here, but we all starting about 5 years ago, I think, in the Historical Society, they had an exhibit talking about the Rondo neighborhood, which was a primarily black neighborhood that was right where Highway 94 is now. And Highway 94 was made throughout the 1960s, and they basically evicted everyone from their houses and tore the houses down, tore the whole neighborhood down, and built a freeway, and it tore the neighborhood in two parts. And, you know, things like generational, you know, you don't have your parents' home anymore because your parents' home just got torn down. So it's really a horrible interruption of a community. And so I'm going to let you guys talk about some of the ideas that are being floated and give us a little bit of a history of what's been going on in the last couple of years with the Department of Transportation and things like that.
Yeah, so right now here in the Twin Cities, you mentioned some of the examples of other places across the country. We have an opportunity to do a similar reimagining of our freeway here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So the Minnesota Department of Transportation is in the process of determining the future of I-94 from roughly downtown St. Paul to downtown Minneapolis. And as you mentioned, the history of that corridor is rife with environmental injustice and racism. And Rondo was home to 80% of black residents in St. Paul. And the freeway was pretty much intentionally routed through that community and left it in shambles. So MnDOT has acknowledged that history. To a certain extent, they've branded this project Rethinking I-94. And so now we are at this point where we have to figure out what does Rethinking I-94 mean and what are we going to put back in its place.
Right. And it sounds like so far the Department of Transportation hasn't been very imaginative in their rethinking. They basically are like, well, let's just make the concrete newer. And is that right?
Yeah, that has been our perception so far. And and they're working through the process that every federal highway has to work through, which is an environmental impact statement process, or the NEPA process. And what we've found in these initial draft documents is that while they're branding this thing as Rethinking I-94, they're really not rethinking anything. And that kind of set off the alarms for us, for Mary and myself and others in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and is part of the reason we started to organize around this project.
Yes, and Mary, you mentioned the other night that you have some grant backing and things like that. So let's talk about just your organization and not just what you're doing, but what you have behind you.
Yeah, we've been an organization that has come together organically. I would say that. Alex is a volunteer. I'm a volunteer. I'm a resident of the community. There are other residents. There are other organizations. There are communities of color all along that corridor. And they're not always able to attend the official MnDOT activities. You know, MnDOT does outreach, and you can't find people when you're doing outreach from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. You know, and they do their best, I think, to talk to people. But this coalition that has come together really does represent the community, and that's why it's really exciting. I'm not sure how to talk about our funding, but we were lucky enough to receive some funding to help coordinate the coalition.
Yeah, and that's great. I have also noticed in my experience when I ran for office and things like that how difficult it is to reach out. You feel like you're reaching out, but and also with small business groups, there are so many benefits for small businesses, but no small business owners know about any of them. And that sounds like kind of what's going on here. I had no idea this was going on. In some of your materials, it said that MnDOT announced that they were going to do this better in 2015. That was 6 years ago. And I don't think very many people know that this is going on. Everyone knows that the freeway sucks and needs to get fixed, but nobody knows what's going on. Nobody, and I just find it really interesting about all these ideas. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what some other cities are doing, some of the imaginative things that they've done, and what we can use as an example, and how you're going about trying to assist the Department of Transportation into using their imagination a little more. So when we come back, we'll talk about that. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We'll be right back. I always want to let the music play longer because it's usually pretty good music. Matt's got good taste in music. Matt's on vacation. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for the Matt McNeil Show. You're listening to the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950. If you'd like to call in and ask questions of our guests, the number is 952-946-6205. And we are celebrating Infrastructure Week, actual Infrastructure Week. And I am talking to Mary Morse Marty and Alex Burns, who are on the I-94 Stakeholders Coalition. So yes, as Infrastructure Week and bigger infrastructure plans, we are talking about fixing I-94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul, which is highly needed. But what if we did it in a completely different way than what anybody has been thinking? What if instead of just having it like it is now, just fixed to the design from 53 years ago, why don't we redesign it and rethink it? So that's what Alex and Mary are working on. Alex, talk to us a little bit about some things that are going on successfully in this regard in other cities.
Yeah, so I think that's really the main reason why we brought this coalition together, was because we were frustrated with the engagement and the vision that MnDOT was bringing forward. Well, when there's cities all across the country and across the world that have successfully removed and rethought their freeways. So this is our opportunity in Minnesota and in the Twin Cities to do the same thing. And it's been successful in other places. A few examples in Milwaukee here in the Midwest, they took out a freeway spur that ended up being the new basketball stadium where they celebrated the championship this year, the Deer District. Mm-hmm. That all used to be a freeway where that development was. You mentioned Rochester. That's an ongoing project. Syracuse,
New York. Rochester, New York.
Rochester, yeah. New York. Yes. Syracuse, New York as well is also reconsidering their urban freeways. And then San Francisco, if anyone's ever been to San Francisco.
Yeah, the Embarcadero, which was damaged pretty heavily in the earthquake.
Yeah.
They decided to tear it out. And now, instead of having this elevated freeway in front of their incredible waterfront, they have development and tax money coming in and commerce. It's just fantastic.
And yeah, and I think one more in South Korea, in Seoul. I think my favorite example, if you look up pictures of this, it's amazing. There was an expressway through Seoul that carried over 100,000 cars a day, which is a lot. That, you know, that's on the scale of I-94. Mm-hmm. And it was in the footprint of a stream that ran through the city. And the mayor made the decision to remove the and restore the stream. So it's an urban creek, like a linear park, and it's stunning. And it's become one of the more popular places in the city, and they haven't had any traffic problems afterward.
Yeah. In this article that I was reading from a little bit earlier from the New York Times, if you go online and look at it, they have photos, aerial photos of a lot of cities from before the freeways were built in the 50s and 60s. And they're, you know, they just ripped out right through the middle of neighborhoods. And of course, they always pick the poor black neighborhoods because they don't want to disrupt the rich white people, especially in the 50s and 60s. And so here in St. Paul, of course, you know, the famous Rondo neighborhood that wasn't talked about until very recently, you know, kind of like a lot of other things Americans are learning about our history. So why don't we move on to some of the ideas that you do have as suggestions to MnDOT to get started on them using their imagination to rebuild in a better way?
Yeah, let me start as a resident. I can walk to I-94 in under 10 minutes from my house. And the experience of living near a highway when you are in the city is that there are feeder roads, as you know, Creighton, Snelling, Riverside. These become highways to the highway, so they really decrease the livability of your neighborhood. I think one of the ideas that we have is to slow the traffic and to, if not fill in the trench, possibly, you know, put in a bike highway, put in a slow-speed boulevard, consider more north-south connections, create opportunities for new development, housing, retail, commercial, industrial. We're not using the space very effectively, and it harms our city's tax base.
And it also, you know, I'm familiar with the area you're talking about, and people who live on the south side of the freeway, they don't have easy access to all the commercial places, like right on University Avenue and things like that. Back in the old days, you could walk to a restaurant or the bookstore on Snelling and University, and now you'd have to get across the freeway. So everybody gets in their cars and goes across a bridge, and there's only a handful of bridges, so they're full. And so would this be done in a way that it wouldn't be such a barrier?
And absolutely. And I think that's why we're specifically focused on this corridor, because the story is the same for others in Minneapolis as well. I-94 severed North Minneapolis, 35W destroyed the 38th Street business corridor in South Minneapolis. It's the same story, but this one in particular, this corridor, we think that it could be reconstructed in a way that would continue to provide transportation access. You could bus rapid transit right through the middle of the trench, providing convenient access to downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul. You could do the bike highway. You could extend the Midtown Greenway to St. Paul, which has been discussed, and improving that north-south access. We've had transportation experts talk about this. We can accommodate the transportation demand in a way that improves air quality, reduces climate emissions, and gives this land back to the community.
Yeah, another thing, too, Mary talks about living right by the freeway. You're a distance of maybe five blocks from the freeway. And being at your house, you can still hear the cars on the freeway.
Yes.
I mean, it's remarkable how at night I can hear cars on Highway 12. You know, that's a couple miles from my house, and I can still hear the cars. And, you know, I don't like that. I'm very focused on sound, and I love to sit outside in the quiet. And it's never quiet by a freeway. And so there's noise pollution. There's also air pollution. Do you have some statistics on air pollution type of measures, how this might improve? Or
yeah,
I know you're. For one thing, just so everyone knows, this is just getting started. So I might be asking you questions that you haven't developed yet.
No. Well, without providing specific statistics, I can tell you that if you looked up a map of air pollution in the Twin Cities, it would follow the ribbons of the highways in the metro area. And this infrastructure, I-94, it's a ribbon of poison, essentially, that impacts those that live within a half mile to a mile of the corridor. And there's a number of schools, Maxfield Elementary, Central High School, daycares, you name it. These kids are being exposed to disproportionate levels of air pollution, and it's showing up in rates of asthma, and later on in life, and things like lung cancer, even dementia. It's really insidious, and there's been some solutions talked about, like, you know, could you add more bridges? Could you do a land bridge or a freeway cap or something like that? But the reality is, the only way to address impacts like air pollution is to deal with the freeway corridor itself. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're focused on.
And another thing, it's when you really stop and think about it, I think, and again, the reason I wanted to have you guys on was because nobody knows about this and nobody's really starting to think about this stuff yet. And so the freeway system is ancient. It's 60 years old. And why would we want to just fix it? Why would we want to invest tons of money to just fix it to a design that needs to be changed? We're going to electric vehicles and things like that. Why do we want to have a road system that does not accommodate whatever is coming next? We need to plan ahead. And another thing I was going to say is I have a motorcycle, and when you're on a motorcycle, you really notice how dirty the roads are, oil all over the place. And, you know, cars driving in one spot like that for years and years, the ground is probably just completely ruined with oil and gas and exhaust
tire, and tire wear.
Yeah.
Particulates from tire wear and brake wear, that's never going to go away even when our whole world is electrified.
Right.
You know, it's not going to help. I wanted to bring up the example of Auckland, New Zealand.
Okay, we're going to take a break.
Awesome.
So we're going to talk about New Zealand when we come back on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. That's what I was going to say. Now I don't know what to say. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil on You Heard Andrew Say It, AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. And we've got a couple of guests here. We're talking about building back better. I-94 needs to at least get fixed, but why would we fix it when we can build it back better? And I've got Mary Morse Marty and Alex Burns here. They are volunteering for a brand new group, doesn't even have a website or anything yet, but they're getting it up and running. It's called the I-94 Stakeholders Coalition. And when we left, Mary, you wanted to tell a story about an example of a well-done building back better.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. Yeah. In Auckland, New Zealand, they decided that they wanted to make it faster to go on transit in their highway trench than it would be to drive. So they put in these new dedicated transit lanes, and they are running 250 buses per hour through these transit lanes. When you think about I-94, I think a lot of people are concerned, well, where does the traffic go? Mm-hmm. And they benefited the people on transit to the extent that nobody would even bother driving. It takes an hour to get through this highway when it takes a half hour to jump on the bus. I love that. We're so good at bus rapid transit here. We could do that all up and down the corridor.
Yes, and actually your son and I were talking at another family gathering a couple of years ago about how, you know, he was talking about why would we have a future where everyone has to own a car? He wants to not even own a car. He wants cities to be built and, you know, communities to be built in a way that you don't have to own a car. Think about, you know, I mean, a car is like only second to your house in your, you know, investment and cost in your whole life. And, you know, I mean, I like my new Tesla. It's really fun having that car. But really, we shouldn't all have cars. We need parking lots then. If more people use the, I mean, that's the whole idea of mass transit. We, You know, the cities would be a lot better if we didn't have to have half of the city dedicated to parking cars. So anyway, we, Alex, you mentioned this Sierra Club. What is something that people can do to who are listening to this right now, who are interested in maybe playing a part or you know, talking to MnDOT themselves and trying to promote this type of thing?
Yeah, for sure. So as you mentioned, this effort is still in the early stages, but we're hoping to get a website built soon and find tangible places that people can plug in. But in the meantime, if folks want to learn more about the project, they can go to MnDOT's website and just search Rethinking I-94, and that'll get them all the information about the project. And it, for the Sierra Club perspective, like how I participate in this process, if they go to sierraclub.org/Minnesota, they can find all the information they can about getting involved with our efforts.
Okay. And MnDOT, by the way, is, of course, the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Their website is www.state.min.us. That's confusing, I know. But if you just go, if you just punch in MnDOT into Google, that's what I just did, and I'm on their website right now. So MnDOT has periodic meetings about this, right? Where they're trying to reach out to the community. Can maybe find information about that on their website. Do you have any, what have they done so far? You mentioned earlier, Mary, that the community doesn't, you know, they're all at work when MnDOT's trying to have meetings about this. Do you know what they have been doing?
Yeah, they do. They participate in a variety of ways, but sometimes you'll see them tabling at community events and stuff. But the main meetings are published on their website, and they're about once a month. They have a policy advisory committee that folks can testify at, and also a community leaders meeting that meets once a month. So all those meetings should be listed on the MnDOT website.
Okay, and I would imagine you are planning on going to those meetings and being at least keeping track of what's going on there?
Definitely, yeah. We make sure to attend all the meetings. And also, Mary mentioned, a lot of these meetings aren't accessible. So we're focused on creating other spaces and more accessible hours during all times of the day, virtual and in person, to give people an opportunity to plug in and have feedback and to co-create the vision for this corridor.
Okay. Well, this group is brand spanking new, doesn't have a website or anything yet, does have some funding behind it. It's all of that is actually being set up to a degree that we don't know quite enough about it even to talk about it on this show right now. But it sounds good to me. It sounds like the group has a good future where, you know, it's sustainable and can play a part in rebuilding I-94 in a much better way than it is currently. Alex, you mentioned earlier a timeline that this is supposed to be going on.
Yeah, that's the thing about these transportation projects is they last a long time. You said it started in 2015, and it has a few years ahead of it. Right now, MnDOT is preparing these draft environmental documents, and we expect them to be posted for public comment sometime late this year or early next year. Mm-hmm. And so that's the big timeline. I wouldn't imagine construction would start anywhere in the next few years, but there's some big deadlines coming up, so we'll definitely keep you updated on the next steps.
Okay, yeah, and at least to the degree that I'm able to, when I'm periodically on this radio station, I will make sure and update all of our listeners. But thanks to both of you, Alex Burns and Mary Morse Marty, who are part of the I-94 Stakeholders Coalition, talking about building I-94 back better than it is now. So thanks a lot, both of you, for coming in.
Thanks, Todd. It's been fun.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
Are we going to take a break, Andrew? No, we're not going to take a break. Okay. So the next thing, if you guys want to just sit here with me for a little bit until the next break, or if, you know, I was going to talk actually, because I thought this was kind of related, and I'm super into electric cars, and we were talking about the Clean Car Initiative in Minnesota. with Kelly Morrison earlier in an interview I did a few weeks ago, because she was on the committee in the legislature. And some points that people don't talk about is, without the Clean Car Initiative, there was actually a car dealership that is on the border near Canada in Minnesota. And he wrote an op-ed, and he was talking about that if we don't do this Clean Car Initiative, people like him will miss opportunities to be able to sell electric cars in the next couple ensuing years. And because other states that are doing it will have all the electric cars for sale, and he won't be able to get his hands on any. He's already got people waiting in line for the new F-150 Lightning, the Ford pickup electric car. And he's already got people even waiting for the new Mustang. And so he was making the point that if we don't do this new car initiative, it's going to hurt car dealerships. Of course, the Republicans are saying that, it would, if we don't do it, it'll hurt car dealerships. The Republicans are saying opposite. Again, something to rethink. We have a call I want to get in, maybe while you guys are still here, because it's related to the I-94. Lynette from Chaska is calling in.
Yeah, hi, Todd. Thanks for filling in for Matt. You're doing a fabulous job.
Thank you.
I was thinking when you guys were talking about that, that's so exciting, and thank you for talking about it, because, yeah, how do we know these things unless, you know, we find out somewhere else? I'm going to look into that, and I just wanted to mention that you're making me think of when my grandmother lived in Minneapolis in the 1920s, I was asking her, you know, like one day when she got a car and stuff like that. She goes, well, I didn't really need a car when I was in Minneapolis at the time, because their streetcars went everywhere until, of course, they ripped those out in the 1950s to make it all about the car.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And there was a big conspiracy. That part of that was funded by Greyhound Bus and some tire companies. And I believe the mayor of St. Paul went to prison. Is that Mary knows about this?
I'm thinking GM was involved.
GM, maybe.
Yeah,
we shouldn't be implicated. We don't know what we're talking about. but it was bigger than just somebody deciding to rip it out. It was a conspiracy to make car companies and tire companies make more money. So they did rip out all of the rails. And we had in the 1920s and 30s, the Twin Cities area was actually kind of growing in like Chicago and New York. We probably would have kind of more legitimate, bigger cities with better transit right now. But it all got erased because of these greedy scandals. So, thanks a lot for calling in, Lynette. Did you have any questions, further questions?
Well, not yet. No, I just,
okay.
I'm listening and I'm taking on the information, and nope, I just wanted to inject that as well. So thank you.
Great. Yeah. I'm glad you did. Cause that's another thing that people don't realize. So thanks for calling in, Lynette. I was going to go on to talk a little bit more about some new news about electric cars that Biden, of course, he's pushing even more so on the shift to electric vehicles. This is, again, from the New York Times, and it's also in today's front page of the Star Tribune. And President Joe Biden on Thursday announced a multi-step strategy aimed at rapidly shifting Americans from gasoline-powered cars and trucks toward electric vehicles, a central part of his plan to reduce the pollution that is heating the planet. He realizes that if we don't do this electric car thing, it's going to be I hate to put it this way, but we're not going to make it. Earth is going to be rid of us. Earth isn't going to end, but people will end. Biden, in his first restoring and slightly strengthening auto mileage standards to the levels that existed under President Barack Obama. They were weakened, of course, under the Trump administration. Biden wants to immediately get them back to where they were. The new rules, which would apply to vehicles in the model year 2023, would cut about one-third of the carbon dioxide produced annually by the United States and prevent the burning of about 200 billion gallons of gasoline over the lifetime of the cars. The administration next plans to draft even more stringent pollution rules for both passenger vehicles and heavy-duty trucks that are designed to compel automakers to ramp up sales of electric vehicles. This is, again, kind of we're starting to get the sticks out. We've been using too many carrots, and we're starting to get the sticks out. So if we make it more difficult for the car companies to keep building combustion engines, they're going to more quickly go to electric cars. And this is happening really quickly. I've mentioned this before, but the F-150 is the top-selling vehicle in the country. And Ford makes an immense amount of money on just that one vehicle, and they are already shifting that vehicle to all electric. You can get them. You can put an order in for them now. And they also, you know, their kind of cool, sporty Mustang now is electric. It's more like an SUV, but it's all electric. And more and more car companies are coming out. Tesla, of course, has mastered the electric car. I have a Tesla, and I've gone on long trips, and it's really easy. You can go 350 miles on one charge. A lot of people don't realize how versatile electric cars have become over the years. So, and Biden is really pushing for it. So let's take a break, and we'll come back in a few minutes on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson in for Matt McNeil, and we're talking about a lot of stuff having to do with infrastructure and changing to electric vehicles this hour. A little more information that I mentioned that I have a Tesla, and one thing that was a surprise to me was when I took it on a long trip, I stopped at a supercharger station, and it's a special for a Tesla thing. And I was down to about 140 miles left to go. And to charge back up to 300 miles took 20 minutes. So, and, you know, these places are always by a restaurant or something. So you can, you know, I see a lot of people just sitting in their cars reading a book because it only takes 20 minutes, you know, to get your charge back up. Of course, that's, you know, when you stop at a gas station and you're there for 5 minutes, this is a little longer than that, but you don't have to do it as often, and you're not burning any gas. Now, another very important part of the Biden plan to push, he's kind of trying to you know, make it easier for car companies to go electric and harder for them to stay not electric. His actions amount to an attempt to overhaul a major American industry in order to better compete with China, which makes about 70% of the world's electric vehicle batteries. In an effort that blends environmental, economic, and foreign policy, Biden wants to retool and expand the domestic supply chain so that the batteries that are essential to electric vehicles are also made in American factories. And of course, that brings more jobs. So it's part of building back better and going to supporting American companies. Without a radical change to the type of vehicles Americans drive, it will be impossible for Biden to meet his ambitious pledge to cut planet warming emissions by 50% from 2005 levels by the end of this decade. Gasoline-powered cars and trucks are the largest single source of greenhouse gases produced in the United States, accounting for 28% of the country's total carbon emissions. He also signed an executive order that calls for the government to try to ensure that half of all vehicles sold in the United States be electric by 2030. That's a goal that if the car manufacturers can keep up with it, I really believe is going to happen, because I'm just seeing more and more electric cars. You know how when you buy a certain kind of car, or one of your friends buys a certain kind of car, all of a sudden you start noticing that car. I'm, you know, just getting a Tesla in December. I felt like I wasn't seeing a whole lot of Teslas back then, and I started watching for them a lot more, and they have increased immensely. And now I'm familiar with the changes of the brand new ones, as opposed to even just a one-year-old. So I know the brand new ones, and there's a lot of brand new ones with, so it's really accelerating quickly. So I think that's a goal that can be reached. Reading More from the New York Times article about this. In a signal of industry support, the president was joined on the South Lawn by the CEOs of the nation's three largest automakers, as well as the head of the United Auto Workers. The automakers pledged that 40% to 50% of their new car sales would be electric vehicles by 2030, up from just 2% this year, on the condition that Congress passes a spending bill that includes billions of dollars for a national network of electric vehicle charging stations, as well as tax credits to make it cheaper for companies to build the cars and consumers to buy them. The White House estimates that the regulations would cut 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide, about one-third of the total annual carbon dioxide pollution produced by the United States. And we mentioned earlier also 200 billion gallons of gasoline would no longer be burnt and sent up into the air. So you can see how not only is he talking about doing this, he's really doing it. He's got the CEOs from, you know, the three top automakers, which I assume is Ford, GM, and Chrysler, and they're already going along with him. They're cooperating with him. You know, they're not standing against him, like you would think would be happening. They're saying, yes, we will. We promise to have 40 to 50% of our new car sales be all electric vehicles, as long as you pass this infrastructure bill, which includes a big national network of electric vehicle charging stations. And I just explained that, you know, I think people are a little intimidated by, and I was even when I first got my electric car, I felt a little scary to go, you know, longer distances, because it felt like if I run out of electricity, I'm just stuck here on the street, you know, and I can't just stop at a gas station and put a little gas in the car. I got to find a power station. Well, they're really easy to find. There's the regular type of power stations. I believe there's 7,400 of them right now. We need a lot more than that, but I can find them pretty much everywhere I go. And I have gone on a couple of long trips now, multi-hundred mile trips, where I've had no problem at all. I'm no longer intimidated. I don't feel any more off-put by having an electric car than having a gas-powered vehicle. As a matter of fact, it's great to pull into a gas station and just get a car wash and not put any gas in the car. So people are really starting to adapt to this. It's going faster than I would have ever imagined it would be. And it's also part of foreign policy. Right now, China is kicking our butts in all of this in so many parts. And my small business, we're feeling it because of the supply chain interruptions going on, because China is way too in control of our economy. And this is part of Joe Biden trying to build back so that the American economy can stand on its own again. We're going to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the new jobs reports, which are way better than what was predicted. 943,000 new jobs, and unemployment is down to 5.4% because of the policies that are being talked about under the Biden administration right now. So when we come back, we'll talk more at AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm at home so near West. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil, who is on vacation for part of this week and all of next week. Much-deserved vacation for Matt. I'm hoping he's not listening. Not because I'm not doing a great job, but because he needs a break. So, Matt, if you're listening, I don't know, maybe take a nap or something. Or, you know, go outside and have a beer or something. We've been talking about a lot of stuff so far, some very interesting things about infrastructure and electric cars. And it's been a tough week aside from those things. It's, you know, we have this new variant, the Delta variant, that's pretty scary. And we're having to mask up again. I'm starting to wear my mask whenever I go indoors. Out where I live, we've never really been a hot spot. But still, and I think most people where I live are vaccinated, but still I'm seeing more and more people putting masks on when they're in the grocery store or wherever. So I've started, my family has started to mask up when we go inside. And if we do a mask mandate, it's not going to be the fault of whoever sets the mask. It's going to be the fault of the people who keep fighting the mask mandates. There is some good news in Arkansas. It was sounding like bad news because they had made it illegal for schools to have a mask mandate. And a judge overturned that. He overturned that and said, nope, that can't be illegal. So schools are now free in Arkansas to have their kids mask up. Even the governor, I don't know his name, but, you know, of course, he pushed for that law, and then he apologized for it at the beginning of this week. He said, I sure wish it wasn't a law, you know, but he left out the part about he's the one who signed it on, signed it into law, and then he regretted it. Well, now that's been overturned, so, my daughter is starting college, and her college has a vaccine requirement, which I think is great. It's a smaller school, Pratt Institute in New York. And so you have to show proof of vaccination or they won't let you in that school right now. I think that's going to start happening. And of course, Republicans are going to complain about it because it takes away their freedom. And I don't know why they don't think they're taking away my freedom because I got to mask up again. It's their fault. If Governor Walz makes a new mask mandate, the Republicans have no right whatsoever to complain about him or it because it is their fault for encouraging their followers to not get vaccinated just because their stupid, doofy, loser, idiot leader decided that he wanted it to be that way.
Don't trust Biden. The people don't trust Biden, so that's why so don't get vaccinated.
Did you get vaccinated, sir?
Well, we're not talking about that.
You know, because of course he got vaccinated the moment he was able to get vaccinated. And we're finding out that he came a lot closer to dying last fall in some of these new books. If it weren't for these drugs that virtually nobody can afford to take that they administered to him, he would have died. We're just finding that out now. And then he goes on to start this whole, you know, whatever it is, fight against the Democrats. And right now the Democrats want you to get vaccinated, so let's say not to get vaccinated. And let's make up a bunch of stories like I'm not even going to repeat all the stupid stories about the vaccinations. The vaccinations are amazing. People who catch the Delta variant, which by the way is 0.1% or less, I think. It might be 0.01% of people who have been vaccinated, who have been, you know, getting the COVID, they don't get sick. They certainly don't die. And so the vaccine saves lives. Even if you get the disease, it still will save your life. And, you know, we're hearing all these stories about people who are dying who regret not getting vaccinated. Their last words are, oh, I should have got vaccinated. And it's their fault. It's not going to be Walz's fault when we get a mask mandate. It's going to be the Republicans' fault, and they have absolutely no right to complain about Walz's handling of the pandemic. He actually, it was an impossible situation, and I'm very glad that he was our captain at the helm because Minnesota got through it relatively well, and I think actually quite well. And that was not the fault of any Republicans. The Republicans were fighting him, kicking and screaming, fighting him like petulant little children, fighting him the whole way. So the reason that I'm having to mask up, the reason my daughter's having to mask up, the reason everybody's having to mask up again is because of the Republicans. They've got absolutely no right to complain about how it's handled. Anyway, I went on with that too long because I mostly want to be celebrating because it's Friday and that COVID news made this week kind of hard. And then, kind of ugly things like Andrew Cuomo news is just sickening, kind of stories going on with some of the details in that. And So, you know, it's been a hard week to get through again, and it's Friday. So I thought we'd talk about just some fun things. Take a short break sometimes from just going nuts about politics. And I don't know if anybody remembers Tommy Mischke. Tommy Mischke used to be on the radio 25 years ago, 20 years ago. And I used to love to listen to Tommy Mischke, and he was kind of savant-like. He would just vamp on things, all kinds of different things. And I think he was on for like 3 hours, had a 3-hour show. And he just always made it really fun and interesting. And I'll always remember being a radio fan myself. I was in radio. I went to Brown Institute right out of high school. I was on the radio back many years ago. And I still listen to the radio. I always have listened to radio. I love just the local AM radio stations. I just love to listen to them. And one of my favorite moments was Tommy Mischke. He brought a book along with him to the show that just had a whole bunch of things like, why is a wake called a wake? You know, when somebody dies and then you have a wake. It's from medieval times, when very often, the cause of this, nobody could figure out for a long time. Now it's speculative, but quite often people would think that somebody died, and then they would treat them like they were dead, and then the person would not be dead. So there were, and they discovered this sometimes when they exhumed a body, they saw evidence that, you know, kind of horrible stuff, like it looks like this person woke up in their grave and tried to dig out, you know, because there's like scrape marks in the top of their, which was just probably a wooden box, you know. And they found evidence that people were being buried before they were dead. So first they would have a wake. And the reason it's called a wake is because sometimes the person would wake up. So you would wait in the room, like you know, one of the family members would sit with the body all night and all day. It became a tradition. And part of the reason it became a tradition was because they were there in case the person woke up. So they would, you know, and this is kind of why they didn't just immediately bury people too. They've started to, you know, let's not bury him quite yet. Let's give him a couple days and see if he starts to feel better. See if he's, you know, I'm not dead yet. I'm feeling better, you know, kind of moment. So that was a thing. And then you might have heard the term saved by the bell. That came about because when they did then, they would have the wake, they'd wait a couple days, and then they'd still go, okay, well, let's bury him now, but let's run a string. Let's tie a string to his finger and then run the string up through the ground to a bell so that if he wakes up, he can ring the bell. And then the term graveyard shift came about because then they hired somebody to sit all night in the graveyard to listen if any bells rang. So when the bell would ring, then that guy would start to dig the body up, and then that's how the term saved by the bell came. So we just covered three of them. Why a wake is called a wake, how saved by the bell came about, and graveyard shift being what, you know, when you get a job and you say you're on the overnight shift, we call it the graveyard shift. So there's some fun tidbits from Tommy Mischke, straight from Tommy Mischke through me to you on this Friday that I'm trying to celebrate the good news and have some fun. And why don't we do more of that when we come back? Let's take a short break. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. If you'd like to call in, if you have any more of those fun tidbits, call in at 952-946-6205 and tell me one that you like. We'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, with some Canadian music for you there. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. Patrick is on the board. Patrick, do you have any tidbits like I was just talking about? No, he doesn't. I know I'm kind of a geek. And I don't know why I retain those types of things in my head.
I mean, I love those kind of tidbits. I can't really think of any off the top of my head that would be interesting right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And some you can't talk about on the radio, too. I know some of those, but I'm not going to talk about those on the radio. To finish, part of the reason that they now speculate as to why people in the Middle Ages were, in the medieval times, were people thought they were dead when they weren't. First of all, of course, they didn't really have as good of means as we do now to be able to tell when you're dead, you know? They just kind of feel if you have a pulse. And when you get lead poisoning, if you get it bad enough, you can go into a coma and your heart will beat so dimly that it almost feels, you know, so it was probably hard for people to find a pulse. They still had a pulse, but it was so weak that people couldn't find it. And they think, a lot of times this would happen when an accident happened or somebody would just pass out after a really hard night of drinking out of those big lead glasses, you know, those big lead beer mugs. So people have speculated since then that that might be why that was going on. It was just, people getting lead poisoning after a hard night's drinking out of a lead cup. But I think that's kind of interesting, too. If I think of a couple more, I'll give some more later. One just popped in my head, actually, I could talk about. I'll talk about it later. But if anybody has any tidbits like that, call in at 952-946-6205. Also, if anyone remembers Tommy Mischke, give me a call. That would be interesting. Or if you are Tommy Mischke, give me a call. So let's talk about some good news that we just found out today, and I don't know what's better is if just the news itself or the fact that when Joe Biden announced this news, he was wearing a tan suit because it's Barack Obama birthday week, so he wore the tan suit, and if you remember, Republicans lost their minds when Barack Obama wore a tan suit back when he was president. I think, you know— I'm kind of thinking it's maybe because Barack Obama was the black guy and the black guy's not allowed to do it because they didn't lose their minds today. But I thought it was a great little, middle finger to the Republicans that Joe Biden put on a tan suit and then announced his incredible jobs numbers, 943,000 new jobs. I think the experts were predicting that it was going to be more like 600,000 is what they were hoping for. Or six and change, like 650,000. But instead, it's 943,000 new jobs. So the unemployment rate went down to 5.4. That's still a high unemployment rate, but we're still recovering from a worldwide pandemic. And so I thought that was great that he put the tan suit on and announced his numbers, both things. It's almost like putting two middle fingers up to the GOP. So Chuck from Minneapolis looks like he remembers Tommy Mischke. Do you remember Tommy Mischke, Chuck?
Yes, I do. Do you remember how he got his start?
I remember he had for a little while on another radio station, KSTP in the Twin Cities. And he, for a little while, he had a UFO show. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
No.
Well, yeah. When he was on KSTP, but he used to call into Bob's Radio Basics.
Oh.
He was the guy in the phone booth.
Oh,
he would call in from different phone booths around like 87, 88.
Oh,
and
wow.
And then Bob got him on the air.
So he just did.
Got his start.
It wasn't a planned show thing. Tommy Mischke just started doing that?
He was a random, like, you know, you could say like just a random guy. And Bob did back in the 80s, he was married to Kevin Berger. Bob did a radio show, and Tommy would call in once a week. And you could hear the cars going by. I'm calling in from XX, University in Snelling. And he'd be in the phone booth. And then he did it so much, and they liked it. That's how he got started.
That's
great. I used to listen to him all the time.
That sounds totally like something that he would do. That's a great story. I'm glad you remember that. What was the show called again? Bob what?
It was Bob's Radio Basics.
Bob's Radio Basics.
That was, Yeah, that's how he got started. Okay. Yeah, because it was really cool because KSTP, you know, always had a way of firing people. Every day Bob was on the show, he would say what show it was, like 344th show.
Uh-huh.
And of course, they fired him. But yeah, that's how Tommy got started. And I thought it would. I thought I'd see if you remembered that or not.
No, I didn't remember him from that far back. I think I got introduced to Tommy, the Tommy Mischke show, and his UFO thing in the early 90s. Because and for a little while he was doing the UFO show and another show, and then he stopped doing the UFO show, and somebody else did it, and then he had his own show, and he would just like play drums. He would just like play drums on the table and make up a song and stuff like that. It was he was kind of like a hidden genius savant kind of guy, who was really great. Well, I'm glad that you remember him, Chuck, and that you enjoyed him the same way I did. Thanks for calling in and sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Very interesting. Learn more about Tommy Mischke. But let's get back to talking about some of the stuff that has been going on, these changes. I'm surprised. I mentioned earlier that with Joe Biden talking about pushing harder on the gas to get all electric vehicles going, and how he's got the CEOs of the largest car companies, you know, Ford, GM. Jeep has an all-electric vehicle right now. So anyway, he's got the CEOs on his side, and they are willing to cooperate. And they're asking for a robust infrastructure plan that adds a lot of power stations to support the electric cars. So that's one really great tidbit, and I'm going to point out another thing in a minute, but now Lynette from Chaska is calling in again, and she wants to talk about electric cars. I'm talking about electric cars right now. What do you have to say about it, Lynette?
I should have talked to you a little longer because I didn't realize you were going to start talking about electric cars. I work in a driving school, so I teach driving, and we always end up getting in this conversation about electric cars, and I'll ask the students, you know, like, did you know that one of the first cars was electric? And nobody knows this. They obviously don't teach it in school. I mean, I remember learning it in school years ago. And in fact, I was just reading, and I looked it up again just to make sure. But Clara Ford, the wife of Henry Ford, drove an electric car. It was called the 1914 Detroit Electric. How come they didn't teach that in school? Because I didn't know that. I only recently read that recently, and so
I didn't know that either. I'm kind of a car geek.
Yeah, so look it up online. This is on the Henry Ford website. And I also wanted to add, you were talking about going to Brown Institute. I went to Brown Institute for radio as well in 1982.
Oh, wow.
When did you go there?
I started in the fall of 82 and graduated in 83.
Well, then I might have seen you there because that would have been, yeah, and my first radio station was working in Crawfordsville, Indiana in 1980, the end of 1982 into 83. So,
yeah. Well, maybe you were there the year before me then.
That's possible. Yeah, I suppose that's possible. But the two buildings, it was quite the quirky place. It was just sad that it's completely gone now. It's just sad.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. And all the equipment was like from the 1950s or 40s and stuff.
Yes.
It was really fun. Yeah, Patrick, radio was really a completely different thing back then.
Yeah,
it was really fun.
Totally. We were cutting things up, you know, with, you know, taping there. And
yeah, cutting tape with a blade and taping it back together. And
yeah, and being that you were talking about Tommy Mischke, I didn't really know who he was, so I looked him up, too. It looks like he does a podcast now.
So, oh, I got to find that, yeah.
Tommy Mischke. I wonder if he probably went to Brown Institute, too, I would imagine. Everybody did back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, we had somebody that was from Norway. When I was there, there was a student from Norway. So it was kind of, in broadcasting, it was kind of the big deal, you know? Yeah.
It was. I didn't realize it was dying out, and they said I had lifetime placement, but, you know, that's not true.
And they're not placing you anymore. I got placed in Burns, Oregon. It was horrible.
That's out in the desert.
They always said take whoever calls. You know,
I know. Yeah.
So that's what you did, and that's what I did.
Yep. We did what we were told, and I don't know. It sounds like your place was a lot better than mine, though.
No.
Well, you have a great voice. So I noticed that right away. You've called in a few times when I've been on, and you have.
I have.
You got a great voice, so I can see you being on radio.
Thank you. There's no radio stations to go to anymore, I guess, but you know, there's you guys. So.
Yeah. We're trying.
So thank you for being there.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling in with that information. 1914, there was an electric car. I know there was also electric cars in the 90s. There was a certain type of electric car, and they started to get popular because they would basically, like, give a car to a celebrity. And so these celebrities were driving these electric cars and talking about them all the time. But they were completely ran out of business by the big oil companies. It was a very short-lived thing. Like I remember there was a documentary about it in something like 1994, and I should look that up too and see. But we've been working on clean energy for decades and decades. It just keeps getting stopped by the big oil companies, and now they can't stop it anymore. And they realize that they're all pretty much all done. So. It's maybe too late, but at least it's going on. But thanks for calling in, Lynette. And I love talking about electric cars and Tommy Mischke and radio.
Okay. All right.
Bye. All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. It's pretty amazing what's going on now because it's been stopped so many times. All these good things have been stopped so many times. My uncle sold solar panels in the early 70s. Of course, they were completely different than the solar panels of today. They were kind of, they kind of heated up rocks. It was like, sort of like pointing what are they called? I don't know what I'm talking about. It was a completely different kind of technology, but it was a solar panel and it was huge and you would use it to heat your house. That was the early 70s. And, you know, there were a lot of discoveries made, a lot of solar type discoveries made because of the moon launch, you know, that we went through in the 60s. We made invented a lot of new things throughout that. And that's where we were going. And Jimmy Carter, a lot of people don't realize, put solar panels on the White House. And the first thing Ronald Reagan did was ripped them off. He took them off. He didn't even like just shut the switch off. He wanted to get them out of town. So the Republicans, of course, because they were funded a lot by the oil companies, Republicans have shut down all of our who knows what would have happened if we would have kept working on solar energy starting in the 1960s and we, you know, really implemented like what Jimmy Carter was trying to do. 40 years ago, we were doing. Also, 40 years ago, cars had much better mileage than they do now. And that was loosened up during the Reagan administration because cars wanted to be bigger. You know, everyone wanted a bigger car, and the car companies couldn't make these huge cars and get the kind of gas mileage that regulations of the time, the late 70s, after the gas shortage, so the car companies were working on the politicians, and of course it was always the Republicans. They were funding the Republicans saying, hey, you got to lift these restrictions on mileage standards for our vehicles. I want to sell a big fat pickup truck and I can't make a big fat pickup truck get good mileage. So you need to get rid of these standards. What if we would have stayed with all of that? What if we would have kept pushing? What if we would have made it hard for those car companies to keep making gas engines 40 years ago? And we'd have all electric cars now. And there was an all electric car company for a short bit before they got shut down by the big oil companies in the 1990s. We probably would have got rid of the gas engine, you know, maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago. How much better would our weather be now? So anyway, I'm kind of meandering around. I want to come back and talk about what I was going to talk about after our last break. But now, of course, it's time for another break. So let's take a break and come back at AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Coming in 952-946-6205 if you have anything fun, because it's Friday and we want to have some fun today. So I'm Todd Mickelson. We'll be right back.
Traveling in a fight, I'd come in.
We're back on AM 950. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil today, who's on vacation. And Patrick is on the board and doing a good job of playing music. One more thing for Lynette and Chaska. I'm saying this because I'm thinking other people would find this funny and interesting as well. But Lynette, do you remember how at Brown Institute, one of the things I always remember, and it used to bug all my friends, people would say W, and then I would say, no, it's W. That was one thing I learned at Brown Institute. They said, you don't say W, say W. You have to enunciate. Because, of course, a lot of radio stations were like, you know, had a W in it, and you didn't want to say W. And so I would correct my friends, and well, that's part of why I don't really have friends anymore. But I thought you'd get a kick out of that, Lynette, and maybe other people would as well. So the thing that I wanted to talk about is that when things like what's going on with Biden right now, where he's actually getting cooperation from large corporations, that means that things are turning in an economical way. He's going at these things with the economy in mind, and it's, you know, everything's about money. So when you make it so that it's going to be beneficial money-wise for a large corporation, you can make things work. I always used to think, why don't we, you know, work with the oil companies and try and shift to a different, you know, solar energy or something, but still let them keep the power. You know, subsidies for the oil companies to stop processing oil and start working with solar energy. So they can still be the most powerful corporations in the country, but now they're doing it with solar power instead of oil. You know, I always used to think solutions like that would make sense. And it sounds like that's kind of what Joe Biden's doing right now. He's trying to get business to work better in the United States. Part of his electric his details of his electric car push is to compete with China and bring jobs back home. And when you get the CEOs from the top car companies to cooperate with you on going all electric vehicles, then you're doing it right, you know? Here's another thing. Remember when all these corporations said we're no longer going to give money to the 147 Congress people who voted against certifying the election? Well, it turns out that more than 85% of those corporations have held to that. Even more than that, actually, because that number, it was a little skewed because some of their the money they were giving still kind of went into the coffers after January 6th, but then they pulled it. So more than 85% of these large corporations that were giving money to the 147 Congress people who voted against certifying the election have held to not giving them money. That's a huge deal. When the Republicans start losing money from the large corporations that they've been counting on, then they start to change their tactics. And now the Republicans are learning that they can't just do whatever they want to do. Hopefully they're learning that. I think some of them don't have the capacity to learn. Another thing a lot of these corporations did is they provided paid time off for their workers to volunteer at the polls. So corporations want voting to go well. They want people to turn out and vote. So they helped their workers to go vote and also to volunteer at the polls. Basically, social harmony is in the best interest of corporations. A large corporation can operate a lot better when, people aren't in fighting with each other. I mean, you know, look at how we've got people saying that you need to boycott companies because of some stupid ideological BS, you know. That kind of stuff, you know, that happens when society is not harmonious and social harmony is good for business. And also, another thing that is working these days, my friend Kelly Morrison, who's been elected and reelected historically in a place that has never elected a Democrat out where I live, she took no money from anybody that was other than just an individual person. She didn't even take money from the DFL. She was only going to take money from individual donations. And the same thing with Dean Phillips, who's my congressman and also a friend of mine. And he has won and been reelected. Historically, in a place that hasn't, in the district that the last time we had a Democrat was in 1959. So you can win elections by not taking large corporate donations. And a lot of Republicans who have completely relied on large corporate donations no longer have them. And these corporations are finding that it's not hurting them. You know, politically, a lot of these corporations, you know, they didn't know what to do. They thought, okay, we're going to make an announcement that we're not going to give money to these Congress people who voted against certifying the election. Well, then we saw about a month ago or so, maybe a little more, Toyota started giving money again because they thought, okay, we made our statement to the public. Now they're not watching us anymore. Let's start giving money back to these Congress people again. But no, they got caught. People are watching still. And that's another thing. That's our part. That's what we're doing. That's what you're doing. That's what I'm doing. We're watching now. We're not just sleeping through this stuff. We're watching what's going on in our government, and they can't – they're finding it a lot more difficult to be completely corrupt. So we were still watching Toyota, and everyone got mad at Toyota. A lot of people said, I was going to buy a Toyota, but now I'm going to buy something else. And then Toyota pulled their money again. They corrected their mistake. They are actually finding that politically it helps them to not give money to the people they were giving money to before. So that means, you know, things are really turning in a good direction here. We a couple months ago when I was sitting in for Matt, a big news story was that the oil companies have decided they're no longer going to drill for oil. They know that we're done. We're done with that. You know, it's going to take a little while, but they can see a future that doesn't use oil. Also coal. Coal, of course, is even an older kind of thing. And coal mines, there's always going to be some coal mines because coal is used for things other than just burning it. Coal is used to make steel, certain types of steel. So there's still going to be a use for some of that stuff. Petroleum is used to make rubber and plastic and all kinds of stuff. Now, not that rubber and plastic is good for our environment, but I mean, our electric cars are going to need rubber tires still. So, you know, we'll still be using some fossil fuels for things like that, but we won't be taking the fossil fuels out of the ground and burning them so that they put a bunch of toxins into the air and ruin our ozone. Even the oil companies can see that future coming. Not even really around the corner. It's here. And like I've repeated many times, the electric cars are just multiplying at an unbelievable rate right now. So things are getting better. I don't know if it's too late. But things are getting better. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about how we're going to keep it that way by winning the midterm elections. But we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt Another good news from this week is that a lot of people are getting vaccinated. Now, of course, they waited too long, but the rate of vaccinations are going up in a huge way because of this new scare from the Delta variant. So that's good news in a middle of some bad news. And it's so extreme that in some places in Missouri. In Missouri, there's stories of people putting on disguises and then going and getting vaccinated because they, I don't know, what kind of life are you, what kind of friends do you have if you have to put on a disguise to cover up the fact that you want to save your own life? You think your friends are going to get mad at you if you own life, so you have to put on a disguise. You should, you know, maybe think about getting some different friends. Of course, this coming from a guy who has no friends. So Patrick is on the board. Patrick, you know what a threshold is, right?
Yes, I do.
What you may not know is why we call it a threshold. So, of course, the threshold is the bottom board in a doorway. And in the old days, it used to be bigger, like taller. You had to, you know, kind of step into the doorway over the threshold. And the reason it was called a threshold is because in a lot of farmhouses, they were right there with the hay and the dirt and all of the mixture of stuff that they used to call thresh and thrash, like you've heard of thrashing hay. So it was called thresh, and the board at the bottom of the door was to hold the thresh outside so it wouldn't come in your house. Not as interesting as the Saved by the Bell, but still a little interesting. Again, straight from Tommy Mischke, going through me to you. There you go, Patrick. You can next party. You can, you can say all this stuff, and it works. You know, people will gather around you and listen. You believe me, right?
I do believe you.
So, I was going to talk about the midterms when we came back. Now, historically, when there's a party shift in the White House, the following midterms goes to the party that's not in the White House. It's happened historically now for quite a long time, for a few decades. And there's just been a couple of I think only one exception in 2002, and that was a lot because of 9/11. George W. Bush had everybody thought that we needed to keep the Republicans. You know, we didn't want to change what was going on in Washington because of handling 9/11. Of course, historically we know that wasn't true and that wasn't a good thing. But usually the party in the White House, when they first take over the White House, they lose the next midterm. And everybody's saying, oh, the Democrats are going to lose in midterms, and then the Republicans are going to take over the world. Well, you know, you've heard me probably, if you've listened to me on this station, you've heard other people on this station say that I think this is going to be another exception. And it turns out that the guy who's in charge of it in a big way thinks so too. Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, it's his job to make sure that we keep the House in 2022. He's a New York Democrat and chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He told NPR that the party is hopeful that an ambitious multi-trillion-dollar economic agenda trumpeted by the Biden administration will resonate with voters when it's time to head to the polls next fall. You've heard me, you've heard Tom Hartman say that Biden needs to be bold. We need to get this big plan. People need to feel the benefits of this infrastructure plan. And there are other things too. Sean Patrick Maloney, what he says, he quotes, "We're making a bet on substance." And then he says, "What's the old saying? Any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a carpenter to build one. It's harder to build it than to kick it down. And so we're the party that's going to build the future. And if we do that, I believe that we will not only not lose the House and Senate in 2022, I think we'll gain more seats in both houses. Quite a bit more, I think. We're hearing about Marjorie Taylor Greene. She brags about getting 74% of the vote in her district, but she leaves out the part that she had no opponent. So in reality, what happened to that 26% that didn't vote for her? You know, I mean, there was no one else to vote for. So now she's got opponents. More than one, I think, are vying for that seat, and they sound like good candidates. There's a lot of people getting in on the Democratic side who sound like they're good candidates who are running in these districts that have had no, really no competitive run before. So Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's going to lose in 2022. I really think it's true. Further in this article from NPR, that the future includes proposals to combat climate change. He's talking about the current infrastructure bills that are being talked about and hopefully being passed soon. That future includes proposals to combat climate change, overhaul immigration laws, massively invest in traditional infrastructure like roads, bridges, and expanded access to broadband, along with investments in affordable child care and early childhood education, and provide an expanded child tax credit with payments that top out at $3,600 a year per child. These are things that we've been trying to fix, but the Republicans wouldn't let anybody fix it for years. Childcare affordability, that's been a problem for 25 years at least. Tens of millions of American families are already starting to receive these direct cash payments for the child tax credits. He says further, that's a huge thing for a family trying to pay for the kids' basketball shoes or keep food in the fridge till Saturday when it's been running out on Thursday. The monthly credit is scheduled to last 1 year, but some Democrats have already discussed making it permanent. These are the types of things that if we get this done, and we're already talking about, even Bernie, you know also that Biden is doing this in a really smart way. And of course, it's not just him. It's the people all around him. Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, is a big part of making these things work. And she's working on infrastructure at the heart of the problem that was first caused back decades ago from the way that Reagan handled foreign policy down in middle Latin America. And made such a mess down there. That's why people are trying to leave those countries now. She's going down there and trying to make things work better down there so that less people make the choice of making this dangerous journey up to our country. That's how she's doing it. So the Biden administration is going about this in a really smart way. We talked about how they have the cooperation of the large corporate car companies and other corporations. And even Bernie Sanders on the other side, the progressives are going along with it. And Bernie Sanders is saying, you know, he can be like FDR. And if he is like FDR, we're not going to lose the midterms. We're going to win the midterms. So that's our celebratory show for this Friday. Again, I'm Todd Mickelson in for Matt McNeil, and I'll be back on Monday.